Welcome to Reboot Republic, the podcast that goes behind the headlines and looks at the big issues in this republic of inequality. We are the podcast of solutions and the podcast of hope. I'm your host, Rory Hearn, and I'm delighted to be joined today by Professor Aoife McLysett, who is a professor in genetics in Trinity College Dublin. Aoife, thanks for joining me today on Reboot Republic.
My pleasure.
Aoife, we're hitting over 700 cases yesterday. We appear to be in another wave. What's your assessment of where we're at now?
Well, I suppose, the 700 cases yesterday was a bit of a shock, wasn't it? And it was pretty depressing news. The only glint, the little chink of optimism that I'll keep alive for a moment is that it was a bit of a blip, that it's not quite that bad. There is a possibility maybe that people delayed their tests over Paddy's Day, and that's why there was a bit of an accumulation at the end of the week. But setting that aside, even without the 700 yesterday, even before that, I wasn't happy with the numbers because they weren't coming down. They were potentially gradually increasing if you look on a national scale. And so what I think, and what actually in the Independent Scientific Advocacy Group, what we've been saying since January, unfortunately, is that this lockdown isn't really a lockdown like our previous one, and it wasn't working, especially wasn't working for the B117. So this new variant that was first recognized in the UK, that it's because it's more infectious, you need to do a bit more. It's just a bit harder. And we could see that when the case numbers were dropping in January and February, they weren't dropping evenly. The old variant was crashing, but B117 was staying stable. So basically what we're doing at the moment is enough, hopefully enough to hold steady with the B117, but not enough to get us anywhere or to get us out of this. And that tells us that, we're at this kind of fine knife edge, basically. Mm. And any change could send us back into exponential growth, unfortunately. And that's kind of what I'm worried about, especially because we've been using up a lot of goodwill. We've been in lockdown for a long time, and most people are doing everything humanly possible.
Yeah.
And to ask them to, when you say do more, they go, what? Like, what do you mean more? There's no more for me to do. Yeah. And it's true, because the gaps are elsewhere, in terms of what needs to be done to make this more effective. But that's my worry, that people are going to just say, what are we doing this for? I can't do it for any longer. And the government has yet to articulate a strategy, so we don't know why we're doing it either. And I think when you look, brilliant, one of the things about Jacinda Ardern that has been brilliant is that she communicates very clearly, very openly. And so she brings the people along with her, even when she has to impose, a lockdown. They go, yeah, we get it. We know why we're doing it. We're on board. Mm. And we had that last year. This time last year, we had that. But now we don't know what we're doing it for. So people are getting very frustrated. And so I'm worried that we're going to learn the hard way yet again, that we're going to that the numbers are not stable, that we're going to see an increase and everything that goes along with that, increased cases, hospitalizations and deaths, and that we'll learn the hard way one more time. That's my concern, actually.
And it does seem very much that that's a real possibility, and that, I think the problem is, as you said, there's a number of issues, that the communication, which means that a population that is utterly stretched, utterly, we're living in privileged situations, but, I have young kids and at home, I have a teenager, this is extremely difficult. We've got so many people isolated, so many people in, overcrowding, in, difficult situations, that people's mental health, that people have, we've gone through, it's the second longest, days in lockdown in Europe. This population is really suffering. That how do you move forward and bring the population along with a strategy of continued lockdown?
I think there has to be a purpose to the lockdown, and that's what we're lacking at the moment. I think, and so the government mentioned when they launched their new, path forward or whatever they called it, they said it's about the data, not the dates. But the only thing they published in their document was dates. And sometimes people are hung up on those dates. They're thinking about the 5th of April, they're thinking about the 12th of April. I think we need to tell people, look, this is what we're trying to achieve, and this is what We gain when we do this. And I think one of the ways of leading with that is by looking regionally. You know, there's not one picture over this whole country. I think if people see, you know, if we achieve, if the lockdown works in our area, then we can open our schools safely and confidently. They could have some retail reopening as well, potentially, and a few things like that. I think that's one thing. It'd be better, you know, of course we want to get there as a country as a whole, but it'll start regionally, because it's not a problem that solves itself all in one day. So I think the government needs to say, you know, what we're trying to achieve, what we're trying to do here is we are trying to get the numbers down low so that we can do all of these things, but you've got to back it up with the things that they missed last year. When we were in our first lockdown, all we could hear was that the lockdown was bringing the numbers down. It was buying time to put other structures in place so that we wouldn't need another lockdown. But those structures were never. And scandal that, you know, a year into a pandemic, we're still haggling with our public health and, you know, we're haggling with them essentially. And that's a scandal. This is, if we don't want lockdown, which nobody does, we have to have the other structures in place that mean we can manage this and monitor it and contain it in other ways. So I think the thing that needs to be done is we need to make a pact. You know, the politicians need to make a pact with the people of what we're trying to achieve, what we're aiming for here. And, you know, then we can say, okay, we can do this, because the people are actually, when you look at opinion polls and that kind of thing, people are quite willing in the sense that you'll see that people will say, I'm willing to do a lockdown if it means that we can open afterwards and things like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, like, even despite being in the second, you know, longest lockdown in Europe, the absolutely overwhelming majority of people are still confining themselves, you know, following all the regulations. You know, so it is, you know, it is a very small minority of people who aren't, and for different reasons. And we know, and, you know, you've highlighted this as well, the whole issue of employers, you know, forcing people to go to work and go into, you know, not to be able to work from home. So, no, I think that, you know, it's very clear to me that, you know, we need to have a strategy. And, you know, you've set that out, that the government lacks that kind of strategy that is actually going to get us, you know, through the point at which, you know, vaccines start to make a difference. Because it seems to me that all the communication is around, we'll get the vaccines, it's all about the vaccines. But of course, and maybe you could explain, you know, scientifically, why relying on the vaccines isn't enough. And then maybe we could talk a little bit about what are the things we need to do specifically, because they need to be talked about. But maybe first, just why, what do you think of that strategy around it's all about the vaccines?
I think,
why is that problematic?
So on a few levels. So one thing is that when they have been saying it's all about the vaccines, they haven't been clear about the fact that we get the benefit of the vaccines only, we get the population benefit only when the population is vaccinated. So that'll mean just about everybody who's eligible and willing to be vaccinated has received it. And that's because, you know, for any vaccine, it won't take in 100% of people. There are people who will have, maybe their immune system is suppressed, perhaps because they've had an organ transplant or some other reason. They'll take the vaccine, but it mightn't work in them. You know, there's a higher chance it doesn't work in them than maybe other individuals. And then there's people who would be ineligible for the vaccine for other reasons. And those people won't be protected until the population is protected. So what have we been doing this last year? We've been trying to protect people. And why would you stop now? The other thing, so that takes time to get the vaccination rolled out to all of the people. And the perception that many people have is that as soon as they receive the vaccine personally, that then they can go back to normal behavior.
Yeah.
And I think that's one thing that hasn't been communicated well with people, you know, because the government has been emphasizing, oh, we're starting today, kind of, you know, this week, this is happening, and that progress is good. But I think they haven't been talking about it as a path until November. They've been really implying that it was a much shorter term thing. And of course, the vaccines were approved and started becoming available in December, and we had our worst crisis after that, as a perfect illustration, the fact that the vaccines being available isn't enough. They have to be delivered to really have their impact. Then we have the issue that also that in this intervening time, the worry is that if we say, because you hear a lot of people saying this, oh, once the elderly and the vulnerable are vaccinated, then we go back to normal.
Yeah.
And so once the elderly and the vulnerable are vaccinated, that will be really, really good. But it won't stop the crisis in the health system, because when we look at the individuals who are ending up in ICU, the majority are under 65. So these aren't in our vulnerable slash elderly grouping that we talk about. And if we take the brakes off and just let the infection run through the population, you know, those numbers in ICU are the numbers that get there even under these really stringent controls to try and stop infections happening. So we'll have a completely overwhelmed hospital system, unfortunately. So, you know, this is a bad enough infection that, you know, even in what we consider to be the known to be vulnerable group, there's going to be a serious amount of illness and a serious disease burden. And then there's just that, you know, we also threaten the vaccination program by having such high case numbers and by importing new variants all the time. And, you know, there's mounting evidence that the vaccines have, the vaccines work a bit less well against some of these new variants. Now, this is still emerging information. I don't want people getting too like worried or anything like that, but I think it's just a warning we should heed, you know, that, you know, so we see that, you know, the antibody response is not as good against the new variants. The antibodies that you generate from a previous infection with an old variant or from the vaccine is not as good against the new variants. Your immune system is more than just your antibodies, but still this is a warning we need to heed. So there's all of these different reasons why we shouldn't just rely on the vaccines. And I think, but one of the most compelling ones is that we don't want to spend until October, November, or whatever time in this situation of lockdown with these persistently high numbers and everything that goes along with that. So the vaccines are really important. They're brilliant. They are going to make a big difference. But I think viewing them as the single thing that fixes everything is a mistake. And it's even, I'd say, negligent. So I don't know if that explains it well enough.
No, no, it does. Absolutely. And I think that's in many ways the point, is that, you know, vaccines are clearly, as you say, you know, vital. They're essential that we get them rolled out as quickly as possible. And of course, that is an issue in and of itself. But that even there's a long way to go from here to November. And in particular, as you say, you know, potentially other variants, but even that the social cost, the economic cost, the well-being cost to our population of continued lockdown between now and November, and potentially further, you know, if you know, if the vaccination is delayed, or, you know, where we're going in the future, we don't know after that. But in terms of a strategy for that period, the next 6 month period, and even right now, because we're seeing the cases going up in particular, maybe you could talk about the quarantine, and then we could talk about public health, because I know there are two key things that need to be addressed and need to be really, I think, talked about specifically, because there's a lot of, you know, lip service being given rather than actually the detail. OK, what are we being done? So we hear today now we have the announcement of the hotel quarantine system being put in place, and the contract has been given to hotels to run it. How do you see that sufficient with the 33 countries? Or is there an issue that we have the likes of the US and travel for all those other countries outside of those 33, basically free run in and out?
No, it's not sufficient. I mean, it's encouraging that the government have finally moved in this direction, when for a long time they were saying it couldn't be done at all, or at least, or they weren't willing to do it at all. But it's not enough, because, you know, when we see with this virus, you know, it doesn't stay in one country for long. The variant that is now the variant we're dealing with was first found in the UK. The variant we had before this one was first found in Spain. And of course, this whole thing originated in China, as far as we know. You know, so this, you know, just picking a country of where you first noticed something isn't enough to define where it is. You know, you could just as easily describe the B117 variant as the Irish variant if you wanted to. And if they weren't doing genomic surveillance in the UK and they hadn't noticed it there first, and, you know, we would be noticing it. So the virus moves around. And so picking a short list of countries and saying these are the ones we're going to quarantine doesn't make sense. same, and that would be, even be true even if people were coming in on private jets and they were the only passenger. But you know, people aren't coming in where they're the only passenger on a plane. They're coming in commercial flights with lots of other passengers. So you have somebody on this plane who's originated in one of these 30 countries or 33 countries. And then we have, you know, other people on the plane who won't be asked to quarantine because they didn't come from one of those countries. And they've been in a transit lounge together or any of these kind of things. And we know, we've seen in previous cases that transmission events occur on the air side in airports as well. You know, so there was a very well-documented case, actually, was a flight coming into Ireland last summer. And this is one of the examples where, you know, we saw what the reverse contact tracing, the retrospective contact tracing can do. So there was this plane came in and there were different individuals on that plane who were infected. This ended up in 59 cases in, you know, several different areas of Ireland, I think six different health areas. And they figured out, they looked at these, they figured out actually there wasn't even just one infection getting onto that plane. There was more than one person infected. And some of them probably caught it in the airport waiting areas. So, you know, just saying this individual came from one of the countries on our list, therefore this individual needs to quarantine, but the person who sat beside them in the plane or in the airport lounge or whatever doesn't need to, is kind of nonsensical. But also that, you know, we know that no matter the variants that are described, we know that the case numbers are high in lots and lots of other countries. So, you know, if somebody's coming from Austria or France, they may well be carrying one of, they may well be infected and they may well be carrying the B1351, which is the one identified in South Africa, or P1, the one identified in Brazil, which are ones that we're concerned about at the moment. You know, we don't want those getting in, but they won't come from people necessarily whose flight originated in those two countries, because those variants are around the world now. So if we're serious about keeping these new variants out, which we should be, because we don't want to add this extra level of difficulty, and we can see what B117 has done, it's made it much harder for us, and we don't want to add another level of difficulty, so we should be serious about keeping them out. And that means quarantining all arrivals.
And it seems like I think the worry would be that with the government saying now we're doing hotel quarantine, that it's a bit like, oh, the hotel quarantine issue is dealt with. And what you're setting out there is that in many ways, it's okay, it might stop a certain amount in terms of those people coming from those 33 countries. But theoretically, you could have a plane coming in from the UK which has people from one of those 33 countries, and they are taken off the plane when they come off and go into hotel quarantine. But everyone else in the plane who is mixed with them and potentially picked up that variant is off traveling around Ireland and spreading it around.
Potentially, yeah. And if you look, I mean, if you look at the list of countries, I don't know if there are direct flights from even any of them. You know, so those people are not coming in on direct flights from those countries in the large part, you know. So the list of countries are going to be people who are taking connecting flights with other people who will not be on the list. So it's an obvious gap in the, and you're just hoping that the person wasn't infectious while they were traveling, or that you know, or that they, whatever other procedures and protocols were in place in the airport and the plane were sufficient that even if they were infectious, the person can catch it. Yeah. But you're taking chances.
Yeah, no, you really are. And it seems to me like it's a real, you know, and we spoke to Niall Conroy, who is a public health in Australia in relation to this. And he set it out like the mandatory hotel quarantine and the following up, and even people who were being infected in Australia were being quarantined, was central to how they dealt with it. Yet here it's very much seen as an aside issue. It's not central at all to the strategy, is it?
Well, so what we're doing here is you could even characterize it as quarantining everybody except ineffectively. And whereas, you know, rather than targeted quarantine, which is just, you know, so this is the difference between having targeted interventions and, you know, population level interventions. So the targeted interventions are inconvenient only for the people who need it, you know. So it's you know, the people who need to be quarantined, it's a great inconvenience for them, but the inconvenience is very much limited to those cases. And for me, I mean, the way that I think about it is, you know, the obvious thing, if we could wind back the clock a year, it's clear that we should have had, we should have done this if we had a crystal ball. We didn't have a crystal ball at the time, obviously. But, you know, if we had done this from the beginning, we would have the country COVID-free. You know, we would have had perhaps the first few cases that got through before we knew something, then, you know, we wouldn't have been re-importing it. But instead, we didn't do that. And we can't wind back the clock, but we did wind back the pandemic, and we did that last summer. We got ourselves back to the situation, which was where we had hardly any cases in the country, a really, really small number of cases, and we re-imported it. And we know this from the genomic surveillance. So Professor Paddy Mallon, who works in UCD and St. Vincent's Hospital, he led a project where they sequenced samples from patients in the first wave and the second wave. And so in the first wave, we see you can look at them and you can see the variants. And this isn't variants of concern. So there's we got used to talk about variants as the scary things, but variants is just any kind of variation in the virus DNA sequence. And so you can just recognize the relationships. And so you can see in the first wave, we had a few different variants in the country. So we had brought it in multiple times in the first wave, but those were all stamped out by our first lockdown. Our first lockdown was very, very effective. And in the second wave, we don't see those first wave variants anymore. We drove them to extinction, but we imported a new variant, which was first spotted in Spain and then spread around Europe. And so we wound back the pandemic clock and we started all over again and made the same mistakes the second time, which is we let it all in again without any quarantine. You know, so that's very frustrating. That's very, very frustrating. And what the argument I kind of hear from people sometimes is they say, okay, yeah, but that was last year. This is now, it's too late now. The vaccines are coming. There's no point in doing anything because the vaccines are coming. And unfortunately, I'm not as optimistic as them that there's, you know, that this is all going to be over without any great inconvenience in the short term. I think we're learning the hard way that this is a long-term problem. At least, you know, I think the government have been thinking in periods of weeks and months. And, you know, here we are a year in and, you know, the summer of 2021, in terms of even domestic holidays, we're concerned, will this be happening? So it's not too late because, you know, unfortunately, this can drag on. And, you know, and it's never too late to save lives is the other thing. You know, when we have these high case numbers, we end up with deaths, unfortunately.
Absolutely. I think that brings us on to the issue of public health, which I know is something that really needs, you know, focus and explanation. What needs to be done on that?
Well, I think we should not be haggling with the public health doctors over the resources they've been asking for. If you listen to them, I mean, it's shocking. They don't even have good IT systems. And this is something that, you know, that they hampered even just in reporting and track cases, and because they are dealing with pen and paper so much of the time and they can't link things up easily. And one of the things we really want to see in this situation is we want to notice the links in between different cases so that we can link them up and we can understand what's happening. And they haven't been doing that. And I think there's been a few things. Like, one thing seems to be is that people don't really understand what public health is and what it's capable of. I think a year ago, people didn't know about it at all. I think now many people think it just is the testing and the contact tracing. And that is that's public health in its entirety. But it's much more than that. And it is, I think, really key to solving the problem we're currently in. So first of all, the contact tracing, just on the point of testing and tracing, the contact tracing we're currently doing is really limited, because let's say I tested positive today, they would ask me who I saw yesterday and the day before. And they're thinking about who maybe I passed it on to. Yeah. But they're not trying to find where I got it from. So if I got it a week ago, because I went into a pharmacy or something like that, they're not going to go back to that pharmacy and try to find the other people who were there at the same time and, you know, really contain that. And that's just a choice, in the sense of in Ireland, they decided to not do that. That has other knock-on consequences, because when we come to opening up or the talk about opening up, people will say, oh, there's no evidence that anybody ever caught it in a such and such a place. Yeah, it's like, yeah, because we have declined to collect that evidence. You know, we haven't looked for the evidence. So that's one thing. So that would help, because that would mean they could trace back to last Monday and see, you know, I caught it in such and such a place. They would see the staff there, the other people who were there around about the same time as me. And all of those people could then isolate as a precautionary thing, and we can potentially then contain this. And that means that would be contained, and it wouldn't become a big outbreak and ending up with all of the other big drastic measures we need when we have extraordinary outbreaks. Another thing that public health doctors will do is they'll know their locality. So they will know the people and they'll know the events. And so they'll be able to much better recognize what's going on. And really importantly, they will have social inclusion type measures that can try to reach out to marginalized groups who might not normally be interacting with a GP or the other health services that we're essentially rely on. You know, we tell people, well, you know, contact your GP.
Yeah.
Stay at home, you know, like you've got space to stay at home.
Yeah.
You've got space to isolate. So there's all these presumptions that people have facilities and they have networks and all of these things. And it's not true. And it's not true for everyone. And so one of the things that public health doctors can do is they're within the public health units, they can have a social inclusion unit and they will try to properly reach out. And one of the extraordinary success stories that we see globally is in a city in India, which name I forget, I apologize, but it was a very, very densely populated city with a big densely populated slum as well.
Mm.
And these are, of course, deprived areas and people who didn't typically trust or interact with the National Health Services. And they sent in community liaisons and people who could gain the trust and talk to the people there. Help them get tested, give them somewhere to isolate if they need to isolate, and they got it under control. So that's a much more difficult problem. We don't have anything like that difficult a problem in Ireland. We have crowded accommodation and we've got some poor working conditions, but not on that scale. But no. We haven't even started trying, it seems, or at least we're not empowering our public health doctors to do it. And so we see in Ireland, you know, you have individuals living in cramped accommodation. These people are also typically in low-paying jobs with possibly poor working conditions too. So if we even just hypothetically imagine somebody working in a meat plant, because we've heard about meat plants before. So somebody working in a meat plant gets infected. And let's say they discover first that they're a contact of a case in work. So they're told to stay at home.
Mm.
If their employer lets them stay at home, that's good. The employment protection for these individuals typically not great either. But so they're told to stay at home, but they're living with six other adults who have different workplaces. Those other adults are not now officially permitted to stay off work because they're just the contact of a contact. They're not the contact of a case. So until this first person tests positive, the other ones don't even have the right to stay off work.
Mm.
But this person's been asked to isolate at home, but they can't really isolate from their housemates. So in short succession, if that person is infected, the housemates will be infected probably before they realize they are. And they'll be going to their respective workplaces and so on. And you can see how a pandemic is sustained in this way. So the poor housing and work conditions are a real problem in this. And they're a problem. They're all of our problem because we're all suffering, you know, for the fact that this pandemic hasn't been brought under control. And so we have examples like that where people are asked to isolate, but you're asking them to do something that you know they can't do. So, you know, that's irresponsible, really, you know, to ask somebody to isolate and go, I've told them what they're supposed to do. They've told them to isolate, but not giving them somewhere to isolate. That is, you know, so supported isolation is a really important thing. And then, you know, interacting and engaging with marginalized communities. These are really important things that haven't been done and or at least haven't been done on a significant scale. It's quite plausible to me that there are, you know, some individual public health doctors who are really trying to do this. They are overwhelmed with the workload at the moment. So it wouldn't be necessarily easy for them. And, you know, they're making choices every day. They have to choose, do I chase up this one or chase up that one? Because I can't I can't do everything. But we don't have this in a systematic way. And not resourcing our public health doctors properly means that, you know, so these marginalized communities stay marginalized. There's not significant interaction with them, that we're not really understanding where transmissions are occurring, which means we're working in the dark. You know, people are, you know, and then trying to figure out. And then the other thing that has got kind of poor attention is the role of ventilation in all of this. You know, so we're still talking about, you know, face masks and 2 meter distance. Those things are important, but ventilation is really important as well. And when we're talking about having people in rooms, and this is where schools come into it as well, because of course we have different rules for what constitutes a contact in schools, apparently, compared to other places. And we all want schools to be open, but everybody wants them to be safe. And, you know, ignoring some of the information is not helping that. And so, yeah, the absence, the lack of support and resourcing of public health has many more consequences than I think people are aware of.
And I think, you know, you've set out that really clearly. And it, you know, it's something we've tried to highlight in this podcast, is that the whole kind of linkages between inequalities, between public health, you know, that resourcing. You know, you talk there about ventilation, you talk there about schools. There seems to me like, you know, we look at the hotel quarantine, the kind of, I was going to say half-arse attempt at it. You know, I feel so much more frustrated and angered, you know, and so many people do. Like, as you say, we are effectively quarantined in our homes and have been, you know, children haven't seen grandparents since last summer. You know, people haven't seen friends, family, and have followed these rules while you've, you know, those figures are shocking. They came out on the weekend, you know, 20,000 people of the 30,000 who traveled into this country were on a holiday or a visit, and you're just like banging your head against the wall. Why do you feel the government doesn't prioritize these things?
I don't know. I'm trying to understand. Because I wonder if it's that they are getting bad advice from somewhere, or that they're really not listening, or that they don't understand the nature of this problem. I was talking to somebody who told me that they were, so this is a he said, she said, but it was talking to somebody who said that they were talking to somebody
in Ireland. It's Ireland, yeah.
Yeah. But they were talking to somebody in the government kind of, you know, round about last summer, you know, where our case numbers looked really good on the face of it. But, you know, you could see that they were starting to go up again. And unfortunately, it's very deceiving at the beginning, because it looks like, oh, it's only going up a little.
Yeah.
But, you know, once it's going in the wrong direction, unless you do something, it doesn't change. And this person told me that the government really didn't believe that there was going to be a second wave. They thought we were out of it. They thought it was over. And, you know, whereas when you talk to scientists and people who understand the nature of exponential growth, it looks innocent at the beginning. And so, just as a little aside, the way I try to explain exponential growth is this old fable of there's a master craftsman who's made a chessboard for some prince or something like this. So, you know, this beautiful chessboard. And then the prince asks the craftsman for his payment. And he goes, well, if you have 1 grain of rice on the first square, 2 on the second, 4 on the third, you know, doubling as they go, I'll take the rice on the last square.
Yeah.
And the prince has gone, oh, I've made a fool, you know, he readily agrees. And then they realize the amount of rice on the last square is like 1,000 years of global production of rice or something like this, you know. So it looks innocent at the beginning. You're like, oh, it's only 2. Oh, it's only 4. Mm-hmm. It's only 8. And that's our cases last summer. You know, it's, well, it's only 8. Oh, it's only 16. Oh, it's only 32. And, you know, it's you know, exponential growth looks innocent at the beginning. And so I think the government didn't understand that it was coming back again. And if they had understood, I think they wouldn't have done this. I think, to be fair, I think they do want to get this under control. Like, we're lucky in that sense of, you know, we don't have one of those stupid governments that kind of says, oh, this doesn't exist and it doesn't matter and all of that kind of thing. Like, there are definitely worse governments around.
Yeah.
But they haven't always taken the right steps. And then I don't know why now they're still not doing it, in that, is there a certain stubbornness or a humiliation in having to admit mistakes. I don't know. Really don't understand, because it seems very plain to me what's happening.
Yeah. Well, there's obviously a lot of interests as well. Different interests are lobbying for the economy to be opened up again, and for, you know, this, the whole narrative around, you know, well, a certain amount of people, it's okay. You know, as you mentioned earlier, this idea that once the vulnerable are vaccinated, then it's okay. This idea that, you know, the younger populations, well, it's okay if they go to hospitalized or whatever. And, you know, this discounting of the impact of it. But maybe just to finish up, because I'm conscious we could continue our conversation. I would definitely have to get you back if you'll come back.
Sure. Yeah.
Just to finish maybe on, you know, what you would say, two things. Firstly, what would you say to the government and what they should do for April the 5th? And secondly, what do you say to the people of Ireland in terms of how we can do to shape this and try and, you know, how can we continue on and what should we do?
So I would ask for the government, I would really like them to just be humble, to say, look, we in good faith, but made some mistakes, but this is what we need to do now, and this is our plan, and to trust the Irish people with a plan, even if the plan is longer than a 2 weeks plan. I think what I would like to see them to do is and properly doing those things, properly resourcing the public health doctors, giving that time to work, and making sure that we get, you know, persuading people, convincing people to buy into this one last push, because it can be done. The virus still, you know, with no matter the variant, it still only travels from person to person. It doesn't, you know, sit in the park and wait for you, you know. And so, you know, it is always possible, you know, we can still do this. And then in terms of telling the people, you know, I would ask them to just have, well, I suppose, it's very hard if the government don't do their part, there's not much else to be said to the people, because I think they're doing everything. But I think if the government was willing to really make, learn from the mistakes and make an earnest effort to really get this under control now, I would say to the people, it's worth it, because we can get this under control. We can have a normal rest of the year domestically, not big international travel, because it won't be time for that yet. But we, you know, but I think international travel is like a cherry on a cake at this point. People want more, more everyday kind of things they would like to be able to do and not be worried about it, not get into a tizzy every time they have a sore throat, wondering are they going to make everybody in their family sick or something. And you know, so those things could be out of the question. So I think it's hard in terms of what to say to the people, because if the government doesn't do their part, I don't think there's much more the people can do, maybe except, you know, making their voices heard. Maybe that's the thing. You know, we have the We Can Be Zero is a people's campaign. Maybe look at that. We have some regional branches of that, and we are trying to encourage the government to think regionally as well. You know, opening the schools nationwide when you've got, closing the schools nationwide until a few weeks ago, when there were parts of the country that were safe quite quickly and other parts that are still really, really hot spots, you know, and opening and closing the schools on a nationwide level, when actually the regional situation is quite different. I think we want the government to look more regionally, and this will be good for the people as well. So if you get your GAA type pride and rivalries, or the tidy towns type pride, I think that becomes motivating for people as well. So the government need to give people something to look forward to, you know, a target to aim for, and, you know, make a pact that they will do their part, because that has been lacking.
Aoife McLeisa, thank you so much for joining me today on Reboot Republic. It's been really fascinating and lovely to have you on, and thank you.
Thanks. Nice to talk.
And just a reminder to our listeners that the We Can Be Zero campaign is there. We've highlighted it before. You can go over to, they have a website, or also on Twitter. Aoife said, they are developing branches in local areas. And it is really important. You as a person, a citizen, can have an impact and influence and change, you know, the politics and policies. So please, if you can, get in contact with them, and let's put the pressure on to make sure that government does do the things that Aoife has set out, because it is so important we can only do so much, and the government has to play its part. And a reminder too, that if you can become a supporter of Reboot Republic, we rely on you for our to continue putting out these podcasts, the cost to produce. If you like what we do, please become a supporter. Go over to patreon.com/tortoiseshack, become a patron, and give whatever you can each month to keep us going. And thank you very much, and we will talk to you soon.